I have a holy envy for the crazy ones, the misfits, the rebels. To have a holy envy is to have reverence for that which you know you do not have. I don't have any tattoos. I know someone who just got one. He's heading to college. I don't have any tattoos. I prefer a tight schedule to serendipity. I was never suspended.
No way.
I was never suspended. Much to my mother's chagrin, my mom actually told me to do something, to do anything to get myself in trouble. I bet you wish you had that mom, right? She was a wise misfit herself, and she was suspicious of anyone as comfortable as I was with authority, with rules, with good behavior. In grade school, she refused to say the Pledge of Allegiance. I can't remember what for, but I remember is how much holy envy I felt when I heard her story. She was a fighter. She was comfortable with conflict, and she was driven by her own moral agency. I can't call myself a misfit, but I do rebel. In my own quiet way, I step at times outside of my comfortable corner, aligning myself in word or deed with an idea or a movement or a person that de-centers me, a person that de-centers me, that sets me off balance righteously. Our faith movement, it moves deliberately and at times unconsciously back and forth from these two very different ways of being. Our faith movement does. We have at times aligned ourselves with and around the crazy ones, the misfit ideas, the rebelliously moral. But there are other times when we have towed the line, hugged the center, and fought with a vehemence to withstand the call to transform. Edwin Markham, the poet, a born and a studied universalist, writes these short lines. He drew a circle that shut me out, heretic, rebel, a thing to flout. But love and I had the wit to win. We drew a circle that took him in. At times I've heard this poem as an affirmation of our tradition. We, grounded in love, we always widen the circle and take the heretic in. But now I hear his words as a plea that we remember, especially in these extraordinary times, our call to widen the circle, a call that in our fear we can so easily refuse. We've had more vigils, more actions, more responses to the world's woes over the past 12 months than over any period in our congregation's history. I'm cautious when I say that these are extraordinary times because it is so easy to be enthralled by our own special time in history. But after deep deliberation, I am convinced that we are standing on new ground and that this ground is not stable, but is shaking like a hurricane. Our vigils were testament to this new ground. I was present for the one surrounding the courthouse in Leesburg, the one countering anti-Muslim rhetoric, and the other here in Sterling, here, right here in this space, mourning the violence in Orlando. And I took the lead in organizing both. That's what I do. I like structures and schedules. I organize things. But I did little more at these events than just MC. Our Muslim, our Sikh, our Christian, our Baha'i, our Buddhist, and so on, brothers and sisters, spoke from pulpits owned by others. Why? We are destabilized, so our center must shift and grow. We are listening to the voices from the margins. We are drawing the circle wider, not because we are smart, not because we are nice, but because we need to survive.
It's true that we live in special times, times that are flaked with change. And our work is to determine what is special, with what potential new life and beauty our world is pregnant. Many are feeling this destabilization. Consciousness-raising moral transformation can seem like a centrifuge, a carnival ride. And we need not feel guilty or anxious. It is right and just to notice the sands are shifting beneath our feet, and we shifting with them. Times like these, we seek new perspective, hoping to put world events into a larger context. And it seems that what works best in these moments is to draw that circle wider. And when we draw our circles wider, we may notice that we're no longer in the center of that circle. And too often, drawing that circle wider will meet resistance. We knew our place in the old order of things. What might I lose, we ask. Do I need to change that much?
Yes.
I understood the old world. But change calls. And in response, we're called to be its champions, even though we must not always be in charge, even when we step aside and follow other leaders, yielding our own pulpits. Especially in the arena of racial justice, in this time of growing awareness of racial disparities in many social systems, from incarceration to education and employment, we are challenged to decenter ourselves intentionally to compose a more racially just nation inside a wider circle, all while perhaps not remaining situated in the driver's seat. The term decentering was first coined by Piaget, the famous developmental psychologist. Piaget claims that decentering is a necessary part of developing human empathy. It happens between ages 7 and 12 as children start to see that their actions have consequences on others. Decentering means to see and feel the world through another's eyes and situation. This cannot be accomplished through mere thought alone. We have to place ourselves somewhere else. Today's justice work urges this kind of decentering, a deliberate attempt by folks of the dominant culture to step from the center toward the margins. And many of us fit into that description of being in the dominant culture. We are part and parcel of it. We are asked to step aside and invite folks from historically marginalized communities to teach, to share, and to lead us so we can see, feel, and hear what their life is like. And this is one way we nurture social empathy. Decentering enables effective justice work. It builds trust and relationship. Indeed, I say that it's racist to suggest that a group of folks from the dominant culture can alone devise and control the solutions to problems faced by people of color.
Amen.
This is how white liberals have often in history helped in ways that were not really helpful. But no justice work is truly just if it's not connected to communities of accountability of the people for whom we claim to be in relationship, for whom we claim to be asking for transformation. A group of folks from those marginalized communities need to be at our center. So in this summer of turmoil, this season of confusion and gunfire, we have been called to publicly proclaim our witness to people of color in spite of the fear and violence, and together to wade into the tumultuous seas of relationship and racial reconciliation. And we will learn those waters will not recede until we move ourselves from where we stand into the waters of unknowing. But more on that later.
I hope you have been imagining, as Reverend Scott and I have been talking about, ways to decenter. All of our lives are differently composed. We have different ways to decenter our individual selves, and I'll be giving you two examples. First, I want to share about how we waded into this decentered place at the General Assembly of the Unitarian Universalist Association. This is the General Assembly that happens every year in June. On our first evening of this conference, the president of the Unitarian Universalist Association stepped aside and gave up his space at the center to first a Christian minister, the leader of the United Church of Christ, and then a Jewish rabbi, the leader of the Jewish Reform Movement. And later in the week, he also gave up his space at the center to a Muslim leader. Both of these two individuals on the first night, they spoke beautifully, and there was applause and a general sense of do-goodiness. Look at us, we are so interfaith. Until, that is, being interfaith meant stepping aside. There was a plan afoot at this General Assembly to move forward with a divestment from Israeli companies operating in illegal, you might also say immoral, settlements in the West Bank. The rabbi who spoke pleaded with us not to divest. He said, please don't divest, remain in relationship, to choose the work of conversation and transformation with the state of Israel instead of the shaming and punitive statement of divestment. You might stand on either sides of this right now. Well, some attendees reflected that the rabbi had no business issuing that challenge. I wholly disagree. That's what happens when you decenter. When you invite someone from the margins inside to lead, you hear challenges, you get thrown off balance, and maybe you grow. One way to decenter is to invite someone from the margins inside. Another way is to step outside yourself, beyond the boundaries that you usually call home. There was a man on the sidewalk just outside one of the doors to the General Assembly conference. As I approached, I fished a granola bar out of my purse, and it was a terribly hot day, and the sun was shining very brightly, and when the man looked up to thank me, he had to squint and struggle, and I don't know what moved in me, but I asked him if I could sit down. His name is Byron, and his wife's name is Faye. He's been out of luck since an injury on a construction job. His knee is totally mottled with scars. He can paint. He can do general maintenance. Faye used to be a childcare worker. When I sat down beside Byron, their lives became the center for me. On occasion, crowds from the assembly would walk by, and I saw the legs, the bottoms of their hands, the way they blocked the sun for a quick moment. Byron put his sign away while we spoke. That matters to me, and I don't know why. Maybe it's because for those moments I was also the center for him, and that matters to me. When I got up to leave, I had a mission to find a local minister to connect with Byron, and a secondary mission of bringing Reverend Scott and also Reverend Leon, another friend of ours, with their guitars back to Byron the next day so he could remember what it felt like to have his fingers on the strings of a guitar. All of this came to pass, but what I really need to tell you is what came next. What happened when I returned to the convention center? I remember standing inside the center, leaning on a pole, trying to figure out where to go next. A security guard walked past me and looked at me strangely. Me. For a long moment, only registering a hesitant release when I looked up at him and smiled with the confidence of one who belonged. That was when I remembered that I hadn't put my General Assembly badge back on, so I clipped it to my shirt with immediacy and with a tinge of fear. Soon after, a colleague came up to me and led me into the bathroom. It seems that a piece of my garment had come unhooked. When she did, I realized that the whole front of my shirt was covered with sweat. I'd been physically changed by decentering. Sitting with Byron transformed me and made me look like I was out of place, perhaps dangerous. That's what the security guard saw, and I was unaccustomed to that look. There are many people that get that every day in every place they ever go. When you decenter by crossing a boundary, you may not be recognizable by those who knew you before. This is a danger, but it is also deliverance. I try and remember Byron and Faye every day because I pray I will not use the gift they gave me for my own purposes. Sitting on the sidewalk, there were moments when I was afraid that that was exactly what I was doing. My friends were walking by. Was I there to look holier than thou? I try to remember them, Byron and Faye, the whole humans that I met, to keep them in the center, to replace my ego with their bodies, with their selves, to keep myself a little off balance and always wading in.
I'm sure most of you recall that film by Cecil B. DeMille, The Ten Commandments. And the Red Sea parts in the film when Moses raises his staff, right? However, Rabbi Patricia Newman shares a famous midrash or interpretation showing how the Red Sea really parts. She writes, "In the moment of terror, with Egyptians at their heels and the waters in front of them, neither Moses nor Miriam are acknowledged by the rabbis who comment on this text. The rabbis concentrate instead on the person who first stepped into the billowing sea, a little-known figure whose name is Nashon." Nashon. The rabbis distinguish Nashon as the one who leads all of the Israelites to safety by being the first to step into those dangerous waters. Yes, Moses had asked the folks to approach the water, to have faith, prepare to cross. But the rabbis claim it was less Moses' channeling of the divine than it was the embodied faith of Nashon that parts those waters. Not the acknowledged leader, someone from the margins. Nothing would have happened. No waters would have been parted until one of those flock had that courageous faith to walk toward danger. And that was Nashon. And the rest silently followed. The farther he walked into the sea, the more it parted. We are being asked to do likewise in our age as we seek answers for racial justice. We've been given a special opportunity, a moment in time pregnant with possibility, challenging us to step into uncharted waters. At the church I serve, Acatink, we have selected racial reconciliation as this year's social justice issue. We will invite Black leaders to teach and lead us, to assume our pulpit, to be our community of accountability, led by people who live the realities. We will investigate the issues straining Black communities, including what keeps so many at odds with law enforcement. We will also champion a new moral leadership to emerge and walk with those who feel their world is unsafe, those who fear for their children every time their children leave their homes the way we white folks can never fully understand. And brothers and sisters, those waters of hatred will not recede if we stay situated in our comfy chairs or if we surrender to despair. The waters of violence cannot abate if we fear we might lose our privilege, if we fear we might be discomforted. So how can we show up, listen, and follow? Can we allow the people who live in justice every day to teach us what it means to help in helpful ways, to provide service that is wanted, effective, and just, both in its implementation as well as in its design? Well, I know you, and I know the people I serve, and I know we can do this. So I'm going to ask us to rise and go to the water's edge. We will learn from our new teachers, from Reverend Martin Luther King, Mark Morrison Reed, W.E.B. Du Bois, Zora Neale Hurston, Leon Dunkley, Ta-Nehisi Coates, Keith Savage, Alicia Garza, the Black leaders of our age and all leaders. And we will place first our toe, then our foot, then our whole selves into that water, pushing back the tide of despair and making through it a path of hope and healing towards racial reconciliation. One step will be to gather for a moral revival 3 weeks from today, August 28th at 5 p.m., Pennsylvania Avenue Baptist Church, for a powerful interfaith rally led by Dr. William Barber, head of the North Carolina NAACP, a man who we were led by at General Assembly with power, intelligence, and humility. So please, I invite you to rise. We're going to sing a hymn a little early. Who is that band all dressed in red? It is you and I and all of us, united in love, humility, gratitude, and service as we wade decentered through the waters of dysfunction and hatred to claim a promised land lying on the other side of this present danger. And there, we will build a new dominion of love and healing. So sing with us. Come, wade with us.